Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
To some, it's the art of hitting several notes in a single syllable. To others, it's the art of showing off. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, those ubiquitous runs of notes known as melisma. And a little bit later, singer-songwriter Alison Moorer's voice is called stunning by some critics. She'll sing live. But first, you're hearing multiple Grammy-winning artist Beyoncé singing If I Were a Boy at the awards ceremony last Sunday. She ended the first line with a big melisma, which is a fancy way of saying that she's running many notes together on one syllable. The technique actually dates back to Gregorian chant and Indian ragas. In the U.S., it was adopted by African-American churches and popularized by soul singers like Sam Cooke and Aretha Franklin. But thanks to the success of divas like Mariah Carey and Whitney Houston and the popularization of American Idol, melisma, whether you know the word or not, seems to permeate pop singing. Today, in another installment of our Thursday series, Sing Out, we'll find out why. And we start with Laura Barton, a music columnist for the British newspaper The Guardian. She's on the phone with us from London. Hi, Laura.
Hello, hi.
So why are we here? I mean, most people don't even know this word, melisma, and yet we're inundated with it today. Why is that?
I think it's particularly with things like American Idol, and over here we have a thing called X Factor. Mm-hmm. It's become a sort of a shorthand for someone performing a very emotional song. So if you do that sort of melismatic run, that sort of vocal contortion, it means that you are A, very talented and can hit those notes. It's a bit of showing off, and B, it says that you are emotionally connected to whatever the song's about.
Mm-hmm. So this is shorthand for saying, here it goes, people, I am emoting now.
Yeah, it's like if you're watching a movie and the strings come in and that's a sign that this is a sad point in the movie. You know, it's the same thing.
Now, is it really a virtuosic piece of singing? Is it hard to do?
I imagine it is. I don't think I could try it now for you, but I sincerely doubt.
Please, I did it before the news, and that was bad enough.
I sincerely doubt I could do it. I think it is a very impressive thing, but I think I've compared it before now to being able to peel an apple all in one go. It's impressive, but I don't know really that it says anything, you know, other than you can do it.
Well, now, Beyoncé, when she sang If I Were a Boy at the Grammys on Sunday night, you know, she inserted a bit of melisma on the word understand at the end of the line. That's usually where you find it, right? At the end of a line, at the end of a stanza, at the end of a song.
Exactly, yeah. And I think Beyoncé's example is beautiful, just for the record.
Because it's not being overused? Why? What makes that different?
Was showing off a little bit, I'll say that much, but she has a phenomenal set of lungs. She part of her talent and part of her, you know, attraction is that you do make that emotional connection with her when she's singing. It has a very, I think you can connect her singing back to her sort of gospel influences.
Mm.
I don't think you can do that necessarily with every person who's auditioning for American Idol.
So why do you think all of these American Idol contestants feel it necessary to try and pull off a Beyoncé or a Mariah Carey-style melisma?
I would imagine because our biggest selling artists for the last sort of couple of decades have been divas who perform these you know, amazing vocal acrobatics, mm-hmm. I suppose.
And so you write that this whole thing sort of professionally hit its peak with Mariah Carey and with songs like Vision of Love.
Yeah, that was sort of a remarkable feat.
And yeah. All right, this is going back to 1990. Let's hear some of the original. The echoes can be heard every week on American Idol.
You turned out to be
That is Vision of Love from Mariah Carey. So, I mean, wow. I mean, you know, it is impressive to be able
to... Dogs are howling all over Manhattan at this moment.
But, Laura, one of the things about when you do melismas, when you do these runs of multiple notes on a single syllable, it makes the lyrics that much harder to understand, right?
Yeah, certainly, yeah.
So is there something to be said in modern songwriting, you know, that about the importance of lyrics? Has it become less important because a songwriter thinks, well, I'll just let the singer go have a go with this and turn it into something?
Probably for that type of song, and I think that's a real pity if you connect that to melisma's history with gospel, when it really was about something, and those words were very, very special. And to make it into a lot of the songs now sung by a lot of the sort of diva-type melismatic singers are kind of really just greetings cards. They're quite pappy, you know. And
well, I'm glad you actually, Laura, that you mentioned gospel, because it's a good chance for me to introduce our second guest. Anthony Heilbutt is a Grammy Award-winning music producer, and he's the author of The Gospel Sound, Good News and Bad Times. He's on the phone with us from right here in New York. Anthony, welcome.
Hello.
You have called melisma the gospel gargle. Why?
No, I call the decadent version the gospel gargle and the Detroit disease. And I call it the Detroit disease because so much of it emanates from the influence of singers like Stevie Wonder. Mm-hmm. But its origins are in something that I consider at least artistically sacred. Melisma comes out of the moans of the gospel church and a style that's associated with what's called Dr. Watts singing, and that's based, Laura, on the famous English poet Isaac Watts, who composed so many of the hymns mm-hmm. that were popularized in the black church. And in fact, I'd just like to elaborate on something earlier. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
I'd like to elaborate. In fact, in melisma, at least as it's practiced in the church, where it's usually referred to as runs, mm-hmm. and even in the old days, frequently as flowers and frills, melisma can occur anywhere. It could occur on the second or third word, and it always had some sort of emotional and musical intention, so that back in the day, audience would applaud a melismatic pattern because they saw it as improvised.
So you
and it, frequently it was accompanied by slurs and my favorite sound, blue notes, mm-hmm. and which made anything more appealing and seemed even more profound.
So Anthony, you're saying there's nothing wrong with the melisma as a technique. Your problem is with its the way it's sort of been bolderized in
yeah,
pop music.
I think so. And it happened also in what's known now as contemporary gospel. The gospel that I'm alluding to, that I prefer, is a style that's called traditional gospel. But for the last 40 or even 50 years, the more popular style has been very ebullient, probably by our standards, rather flamboyant. But let me say something, too. And I'm someone, you can see that I'm very much... that I'm not very impressed by the extravagant technique. Nobody sweats too much about the extravagances of white blues boy guitarists. Mm-hmm. And if anything, the people who love heavy metal or who go back to idolizing their Eric Claptons and Jimmy Pages, they love those kind of extravagances. But somehow, when they're performed by the interesting oddball characters of American Idol, it's considered, you know, bad taste. I think that rock and roll has always invited bad taste and extravagance. And
that's an interesting point, Laura. What I mean, you know, Anthony's making the point that, you know, the same thing that we don't like apparently in our singers, when an electric guitarist does it, it seems to be okay. Why would that be?
I think it's a fair point, but I do think guitarists get a lot of stick for going a little bit over the top and indulging themselves in with their riffs just as much as you might say the same thing about American Idol or Whitney Houston. I think it's an interesting thing that we invest so much, we take a sign of this sort of indulgent style of guitar playing or singing as a greater example of an emotional response to something, when I think you can have just as it can be just as illustrative by if somebody grunts or moans. As in fact, we just heard the fact that melisma comes from moans of the church, and I think moaning or grunting or something like that in rock and roll is kind of overlooked. It can be incredibly effective.
Anthony, would Marion Williams be a good example of an effective use, a sort of a classic use of this technique of melisma?
What song are you alluding to?
How about "The Day Is Past and Gone"?
Oh, that's a very powerful song. That's actually, Laura, an old English hymn which was revised by the famous gospel composer Thomas A. Dorsey, mm-hmm. and he applied a 16-bar blues to it. And I think it's a very profound performance. And in fact, your colleague, Leonard Lopate, once told me that he thought it's one of his three favorite records.
So this would be one.
I would say, yes, it's a good example.
Okay, Marion Williams.
Years past, and gone. The evening shade.
That is Marion Williams. The Day Is Past and Gone. You can see why that might be a favorite of my colleague Leonard Lopate. Now, here's the same technique, the melisma, these runs of notes on a single syllable in the hands or vocal cords of Sam Cooke.
So I'm lost and I'm looking for my baby. Wonder why my baby can't be found, lost and a searching for my baby, Lord knows my baby ain't around, crying for my baby, crying all alone.
Sam Cooke with Lost and Lookin', and Marion Williams before that. We're talking about melisma, the fancy way of saying that you're singing multiple notes on a single syllable. Laura Barton, the music columnist for the British newspaper The Guardian's with me. So is Anthony Heilbutt, the Grammy Award-winning music producer and author of The Gospel Sound. Anthony, what's the difference between Marion Williams and Sam Cooke? Is it simply going from sacred to secular, or is it more to it than that?
No, there's hardly any difference, because in fact the song Sam is singing is his secularized version of the old gospel song "I'm a Pilgrim of Sorrow," also known as "The City Called Heaven." It's the same melody, mm-hmm. and he's applying virtually the same technique, the same strategies that he would employ if he was singing it in the church.
Now,
what Sam did, what people like Sam and Aretha Franklin and Little Richard and others did, is that they simply extended the technique that they had heard. In the case of Little Richard, who patterned himself, in fact, on Marion Williams, and Aretha Franklin, who also grew up under Marion Williams and Marion's original employer, the famous Clara Ward, they were sort of junior versions of this. And Sam Cooke, in turn, was very much inspired by his mentor, the man he replaced in the Soul Stirrers, R.H. Harris. So all of these young talents, these very great singers, were just extending and pretty much replicating. In no ways, really, is there very much difference in their approaches. And that last song of Sam is one of his profoundest performances. It's one of his saddest, most melancholy, and it's just permeated with the technique of Marion's song, "The Day Is Past and Gone," which is all about death.
Well, let's give our Soundcheck listeners a chance to weigh in with what they think. Does a little melisma help or hurt a song? Does a lot of melisma, which is what we're getting in pop music nowadays, help or hurt a song? Does it translate emotion better somehow? You can call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or leave a comment on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org. There's a bunch of comments already. And as usual, our producer, Joel Meyer, has been checking them out. What's it looking like, Joel?
John, I have to be straight with you. There are not a lot of listeners on the Soundcheck page who like the use of melisma in pop music, specifically. One listener calls melisma in pop the most annoying and egotistical thing a singer can do. Another writes, vocal exercises belong in the practice studio, not in a song. And Mariel writes this, I never knew there was a name for it. I just thought it was called annoying. But there is one defender on our site. Greg on the Upper East Side points us to some examples of melisma outside of pop music. He names Monteverdi's opera Popea, the Qawwali singer Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, and the Christmas carol Angels We Have Heard on High.
Right, with Gloria, that's sort of turned into a whole big melody in and of itself. Let's hear a little bit of melismatic singing, this familiar Christmas tune to get us into the break. And when we come back, we'll continue with our look at melisma. A very familiar example of melisma, which may be an unfamiliar word, but you hear a lot of it in pop music these days. And our Thursday series, Sing Out, continues in a moment with our discussion of melisma, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And later, the Alabama-born singer-songwriter Alison Moorer started her career in Nashville, but now she's based here in New York. She joins us to play songs from her new album, Crows, coming up on Soundcheck.
Check out today's Soundcheck blog.
So what's wrong with melisma? Nothing. And there's nothing wrong with whipped cream on your chocolate mousse. But if all you have is whipped cream, that ain't much of a dessert.
For the rest of the story, visit the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org.
You'll hear it in everything from Gregorian chant to apparently every American Idol contestant on the block. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We're back talking about melisma, singing many notes over one long-suffering syllable. It's the latest installment in our Thursday series, Sing Out. My guests include the journalist Laura Barton from London's The Guardian and the producer and author Anthony Heilbutt. Laura, It seems like both you and Anthony feel like there's not a whole lot of room for this sort of thing in pop music, but is there a place for it?
Oh, I'm sure there is, in gospel still, and even in pop music, I'm sure there is. But it has to be connected to something. It has to be tethered to something. It can't just be for the sake of doing it, because otherwise, you know, it feels emotionally empty.
Let's go right to the phones and see what some of our soundcheck listeners have to. Yes, Anthony.
What were you just playing?
That was Jennifer Hudson.
Yes, well, that sounded rather good to me, but she's quite a good artist. Mm-hmm. I think
it was somewhat controversial that she didn't win American Idol. She was the runner-up, not the winner.
I know, but the people who hear an American Idol are tyros. They're virtually amateurs. As Laura says, if a real artist gets a hold of it, it's as useful or as expressive a technique as any. But if it's done by people who don't have that kind of musical sensibility, then of course it can be disastrous.
Well, I think that might actually lead us neatly to Mark, who's joining us on the line from here in New York. Mark, what's your feeling about melisma in pop songs?
Good afternoon. Great show.
Thanks.
I wonder if any of your talented guests might make the differentiation between melisma as a characteristic of a composition, where it enhances the song, or a characteristic of the ego of a singer, such as, hey, look what I can do. It has nothing to do with the music. It has all to do with me.
Huh, that is an interesting question. So you're making, Mark, a distinction between the composer actually writing those trills and roulades and all that stuff in and the performer deciding to put that in after the fact, right?
Right. Well, and the focus either on the song or the focus on me, the singer.
Okay. Anthony, you want to handle that?
I think it depends a great deal on the genre. I'm not a big fan of contemporary gospel, as you know, and that's why I describe the technique now as I said, the Detroit disease. But I think that a gospel composer would expect that from his singer. Likewise, if somebody was composing a contemporary R&B ballad, they'd expect that. But it would seem quite inappropriate in another genre, and people would laugh at it. But on the other hand, the audiences for this kind of music would find it barren if the singers wouldn't employ it.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. Black singing has really been the model for popular singing, and certainly for rock and roll singing, since the beginning. And I think that it depends on who you're listening to. I know Laura has written that she's very moved by the singing of Rod Stewart or Van Morrison. But, of course, they were the blue-eyed soul singers of their era. So today we have the American Idol for the blue-eyed soul singers of theirs. Hmm. They're doing a bad version of what they might hear if they listen to black gospel or even black R&B.
Laura?
I think that's true, but I think that they've made it far more generic. You know, if you listen to Van Morrison, okay, he's impersonating a blues singer, without doubt. But also, there's an awful lot of Northern Irish intonation into the way he sings. Those clipped vowels are very much of his own place and time.
So, excellent. I think that's a very good point.
Let's get back to the phones. Sylvia is joining us from Long Island. Sylvia, you're an opera fan, right?
Yes.
This is the kind of thing you wouldn't even have this discussion in opera, would you?
No, and I'm glad somebody already pointed it out. But also, this type of singing, it seems to me, is found in cantorial singing, which is,
yes,
pretty ancient.
Right.
And it's also found in all kinds of music, Arabic music, some East Indian music. And I don't understand why the discussion sounds to me as though this type of singing were something strange and wonderful and aberrant somehow, and it's really quite ancient and widespread.
Well, you know, I think the discussion isn't that it's strange and wonderful. I think the discussion is, especially if you look at some of the comments that are coming in, people are hearing too much of it, not understanding why it's there. It sounds show-offy. I mean, Laura, is that basically what the problem with melisma in modern pop music is?
Yeah, just that it's come to stand for something without you know, that it's become trickery rather than an emotional core or an expression of something heartfelt and felt in the belly, you know.
So you started us off today by saying that, you know, at its in its original intent, melisma was meant to sort of convey emotion. Mm-hmm. Is it now used instead of actually conveying emotion?
Yeah, I would probably say in a lot of cases it is. You know, it's done to show that you're a show pony, I suppose.
Hmm. Andrea is joining us on the line from Queens. Andrea, what do you think about the way melisma is used these days?
I think that hits on it exactly, is that people can tell that the artist isn't engaged. Their heart isn't engaged. And I think that that's the problem with pop music in general is, now mostly it's about the show and the visual, and we can tell if someone's heart is actually in what they're thinking.
Andrea, were you listening before when we played the Marianne Williams and the Sam Cooke clips?
Oh my goodness! They're completely engaged. Their heart is absolutely engaged.
So again, your problem is not with the technique. It's using the technique without feeling it. Is that a proper way to put it?
Yeah. I mean, you can do runs all day. You know, you can riff all day, and whether or not it's musical is one half of it. But whether or not your heart is there, you know, yeah.
That seems to be what it comes down to whenever you're talking about music. Andrea from Queens, thanks for the call. Let's see what Joel Myers got for us in the control room where all the comments are coming in. Joel?
John, it's a little less bloody this time around, I've got to say. Frank from the East Village writes, Sam Cooke knew in and when not to use the technique. Unfortunately, Beyonce and Mariah do not. But then Grimy in Brooklyn spots a trend on the Soundcheck page. Grimy writes, you all are being ridiculous. This argument is basically turning into when it's used in songs I like, it's good, but when it's used in songs I don't like, it stinks. And Marcella from Park Slope kind of echoes what we heard a little bit from a listener just a second ago. Marcella writes, honesty has a way of showing itself through expressions of art. When the singer is true to what they're singing, a melisma can give you goosebumps. When the artist is simply showing off, the melisma comes across with that same intention, snobby and show-offish. Maybe it's a good measure of who's the real thing.
Well, I'm going to give Jacqueline from Brooklyn the last word, joining us on the line. Jacqueline, are you for or against melisma?
I absolutely love it. I think it takes talent, whether it's coming from classical or pop. The commonality is these people who do it have tremendous talent. So what's wrong with it? Whether it's flamboyance, whether it's showing off, whether it's emotional. It's an artist. I love it.
All right, Jacqueline. We'll finish there, and actually we'll finish with another of the pop divas who has made this style so ubiquitous, namely Whitney Houston. My thanks to Anthony Heilbutt, the producer and author of The Gospel Sound, Good News and Bad Times, and Laura Barton, the music columnist for the British newspaper The Guardian. Laura, Anthony, thanks for being with us on Soundcheck.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
My darling, you. Bittersweet.
Still to come, singer-songwriter Alison Moorer moved to New York a few years ago, but her new album is full of memories of her native Alabama. She joins us to play songs from her upcoming record, Crows, live in our studio. This is Soundcheck.
Please don't cry. We both know I'm not what you need.